Resources Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. It's Thursday, April 14th, so I am tax laggard, so not a lot of time left. And we're here to continue the public hearing on House Bill 5045, which is the budget bill for the Department of State Lands. So I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 5045, and we have today the director and our illustrious BAM analyst. And what I hope we can do is continue with the detail of the budget, but my understanding is that first you want to just take us through a little bit of the information that you brought before us today in addition.
I'm glad we didn't ask any more questions.
We try to be responsive. What you have in this packet of information is in response to questions you had yesterday. And for the record, I'm Ann Hannes, Director of Department of State Lands. You have copies of the Attorney General opinions dated June 22nd and January 16th. These are with regard to the Common School Fund in terms of restrictions about accessing the Common School Fund.
That looks like it's been photocopied a few times.
It has been photocopied, and I do apologize for the copy that I have, but that was the best one that I had in my file. If you have trouble reading it, we will make sure you get even a better copy.
That's just fine.
Also is a copy of the Dahl Report, which is on wetland losses. That was, by the way, from 1780s to the 1980s, and they extrapolated a number of different data sources to get that. And a lot of the earlier information, I believe, was probably from the eastern coast of the U.S. because this was for a nationwide study. I believe Janet should be here shortly if you had any questions about that. We also do want to note that there was a correction to the wetland data that the wetland acreage was about 273,000 in 1982, and that was about 8.5% of the total land area. And so the net loss was 6,500 acres, and then the math adds up as we do that. There's also the response to the question about farmland that was tile drained. And then we have information in response to your request on unclaimed property audits. I do want to talk a couple minutes on the program option package 103, because there was some confusion about that and questions in terms of the cost of the agency to implement the asset management plan. That program option package 103 includes two positions, and the cost of the two positions, personal services, is $268,000. There is $500,000 in there for doing various things that we need to do in connection with any land sales. And let me give you an example of how we might use that. If you look on page 4 of the memo at the very top, when we were looking at parcels to sell, isolated parcels to sell, one of the parcels that we're working on right now is a 200-acre Applegate property that's located in Jackson County. The land was appraised at $65,000 based on the current highest and best uses on improved timberland. But as we have an in-house appraiser, as she looked at that, her recommendation was that if we could invest about $116,000 in that, we'd be able to boost that price up to $400,000, and thus we'd have an increased return of approximately $235,000. It's those types of improvements that we'd be looking at doing, as well as the due diligence when we do our land sales, to be able to get the maximum amount of value out of every parcel that we might sell. So that's the reason for that higher amount in there, and that comes out of the revolving fund that we have within the Common School.
Oh, that was going to be my question. So the revenue that you need to improve parcels that you can increase the revenue by improving, that revenue comes out of the revolving fund?
Yes. So I hope that helps in understanding the kind of investments that we would do, because it would, you know, I would hope that would mean a very significant return. I think it's also important to keep in mind that this is just, you know, kind of in it, this is in its infancy as we're starting out this effort to try to increase the value of the lands and reposition the portfolio over the long term. And I can give you examples like this, but to be able to tell you precisely over the next 2 to 4 years what the return would be very hard. I'd be more than happy to come back and report whenever you'd like about the progress we've made, what kind of land sales we're proposing, the efforts that we're doing, so that you are aware of
So the 2FTE would be to identify these opportunities or to actually bring opportunities into the real world, make the opportunities happen?
I think it would be both. And one, you have to identify the opportunities, such as wind generation. If you want to do any wind generation on some of the parcels that we have that might be capable of doing that, first you have to investigate, do you have the potential there, and then you have to negotiate the contracts with whoever would do the wind generation. Likewise, on those 3,200 acres of in lieu lands that we'd be securing in central Oregon, we need to look at what can we do with the lands. Right now we're in the process of selecting those lands and working through the BLM on exactly what parcels to select. And we're looking at parcels that are high value. I mean, there are parcels that are next to, like, the Pronghorn Resort or the Eagle Crest, or a parcel that might be able to have a commercial office building on it. So, you know, once we know exactly what the best use of that parcel is, those staff would help to identify that, and then those staff would also help to try to carry it out, either through a contract with a developer, or in the case of, like, a smaller parcel like the Applegate, actually making some improvements on the land to triple the value of it. Does that help to answer?
Are there questions or comments? Let's move ahead then.
Okay, great. Do you want me to return to my presentation?
Let's conclude the presentation.
Okay.
And, we also have public testimony on the schedule for today. So anyone out there that is interested in making public testimony before the committee, if you haven't signed up on the sign-up sheet, we would appreciate you doing that at some point so that we can call you forward. Director?
Great. Thank you. Moving ahead to the next program option package, this one, again, is related to generating revenue to the Common School Fund. It's a $120,000 impact. It does involve one FTE. What we're seeking here to do is to centralize our billing. Frankly, right now, some of the billing is scattered around the agency, and I want to ensure that we have timely billing, that we are able to get the payments that are due to the state on when they're due, and also make sure they're, you know, they are collected fully and that we follow up on that. So this would allow us to best integrate that and make sure that the fiscal oversight is there. The next program option package deals with maintaining and improving our lands, and particularly on our range lands. This would cover suppressing fire. Right now, there is no money in the agency budget to be able to respond to any fires. If we have a large fire, or even sometimes even a smaller fire, we need to tell the BLM that we will have to come back to the emergency board and secure that money. And given the contract we've had with the BLM, they actually cover for us and don't charge us for the first day. So it's actually a very good deal for the state to be able to maintain that BLM contract, because it's that first day of initial attack that can be the most critical in making sure that fire is suppressed quickly and that the costs are limited.
Where are we?
I do have copies of, so I brought it today, so let me give you that.
Members, if you have
and
copies
we are
of the slides, we're on page 26.
In the middle.
Do you need them? I can give you a page. And this handout is on page 27.
Do you need one?
No, I got one right here. Yes, we found it.
With reference to package 102, in the past, I believe that the agency has been directed to go to the emergency board and request payment for the amount that's outstanding for firefighting. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And can you explain to us why it isn't reasonable to continue that?
We could, but it also, I think, would give the BLM the assurance that we intend to continue with the contract and that they're not absorbing and holding that the cost of that for a period of time until we can refund that money to them that they have essentially fronted to us for the fire protection. It's honoring that contract.
Has the arrangement been in place where the agency goes to the e-board and makes the request? Do you know when that was first instituted?
We have been doing that for quite a long time. I don't know. Steve, do you have any ideas? 4 years?
Okay.
Yes. The other part of this that we want to be able to fund is doing weed treatment and managing our forest lands. Our lands have been suffering from deferred funding for a long time, especially to deal with noxious weeds and rehabilitation. We've lost parcels to grazing because they've become overcome with weeds, and we've not been able to do all the work that we'd like to do on that. We have about 7,000 acres of forest land that Department of Forestry does not manage for us, and that we want to be able to harvest timber off of that or manage those lands. And this would give us the capability of doing that. We've not had, a specific allocation to be able to really invest and deal with these kind of problems on our range lands.
Can you break out for us the funding between the fire area, the weed area, and the managing forest land area?
We can try to do that. It depends, of course, on what's happening during the summer. I have an efficient staff. I have it right here. So let me give that to you.
Well, perhaps if we could just make it available to Ms. McGlash and she could distribute it to the members of the committee, I think it would be good information for us when we go into the work session.
Okay. And this says about $150,000 for wildfire suppression. So we'll make that available to you. Thank you, Pamela. POP 105 deals with funding critical building maintenance. Our building, and this is our building here in Salem at the North Capitol Mall, that building is valued at about $11 million right now, or a little over $11 million. It's 15 years old, and it really needs some deferred maintenance, dealing with electrical and roofing and heating and air conditioning. We get about $1.2 million during the biennium from rent from our tenants there. So this is a revenue generator for the Common School Fund, and we want to make sure that we keep the value in that building.
Does the rent go into the Common School Fund also?
Yes, it does.
And if you haven't already, would it be possible for you to break out the cost of this and get it to Ms. McGlashan also?
The cost of, oh, sure, we can do that.
Okay.
Of which one of those different projects?
All the components. How much of it is electrical? How much is the roofing? How much is the air conditioning?
We will do that. I do want to note that one of the requests that we do make, and this would be moving some of our capital expenditure money to a little bit to personal services. Each summer we've been doing rangeland assessments, and we've trained some individuals. First we did it under contract, but then we've trained those individuals to help with rangeland assessments. The rangeland assessments gives us important information for knowing what the carrying capacity is of those rangelands. We found that it's very difficult to be able to hire them under contract because we've had difficulty with with doing that. One, once we've got people trained, we want to be able to bring them back each summer. And two, there's just little things like you can't have a private contractor driving a state vehicle. And so it would be much more cost effective to be able to have a seasonal position that we could hire back every summer that has been already trained. The next
page, back to this document on page 26.
Come on, you have to pay the answers. That's just where I'm at. Sorry, thank you.
The next one before you is Program Option Package 104. This is providing money for basically legal costs connected with the cleanup of the Portland Harbor. What we're trying to do here is to avoid liability for the Common School Fund. Since the state owns the bed and the banks of the Willamette River, that makes us a landowner there, and we're wanting to try to make sure that we minimize the exposure of the Common School Fund in that cleanup. As we've talked to other states that have faced similar types of complex cleanups, their suggestion is that we need to be involved in this right up front and be able to make sure that we minimize the exposure to the Common School Fund. With the Superfund laws, we've found also they're extremely complex and very much requires significant amount of legal assistance. And so that's what this money is for.
Representative Krieger has a question.
Last session, we passed a bill that dealt with that harbor and the liability of old companies. It was quite a battle in the billy. Does that, I can't remember how that came out.
Oh, I'm not sure. I'll have Steve come on up and talk about that.
They were in every office in the building, the insurance companies and owners of property. And I was wondering, did that cause you to have some liability possibly?
Chair Morgan, Representative Krieger, for the record, Steve Purchase, Assistant Director, Department of State Lands. Let me respond to your question, Representative. Senate Bill 751 was discussed last session in the manner in which you described it was. The result of that bill was that it established a lower Willamette River cleanup authority that the governor is the chair of. And that bill gave that committee the authority to look for funding sources to clean up the Portland Harbor. It did not designate anybody as a responsible party. It did not establish any entity, government or private, that would be responsible for their prorated share of cleanup. So simply to look for a possible funding source. As to your answer about whether or not that's going to give us any liability, the state's position has been for some time is that we are not liable for the contaminated sediments in the river because the bulk of this contamination came from the upland to the water. That's one of the reasons why we're asking for a full-time attorney general, because we're probably going to have to debate that in court.
What are the precedents that you're basing that on? There must be other cases that have been successfully argued.
Chair Morgan, that's correct. We've had most recently a case here in Oregon with Oregon Institute of Technology on the responsibility of the college in the performance of its duties as to whether or not it was liable under federal cleanup law for an action taken by someone else. And the court found that the college was not liable. But it has not been tried with the state agency, with the large state agencies such as ourselves. And we know that we're probably going to face that legal challenge in the future as we prepare ourselves for the cleanup.
Well, I would imagine, too, that there would be ways to take samplings of the kind of contamination and then trace it back to where that kind of stuff is originating on the banks.
Chair Morgan, that's correct. Currently, right now, today, the investigations on the upland parcels along the Willamette River, that would be River Mile 2 to River Mile 9, which is a designated Superfund site, has been completed on the upland. They know that. They know where the contamination came from, and they have a pretty good handle on who's responsible. As that contamination entered the state's waterway and starts to migrate downstream, mixes with other activities that have occurred over the history, the 150-year history of industrial uses in the Portland Harbor, gets a little bit more murkier trying to figure out who has that responsibility. So that's going to, on the upland side, that's been addressed. On the water side, currently what's going on in the Portland Harbor right now is the Lower Willamette Group is a group of 10 businesses that have kind of come together to try to do what they call a feasibility study and an environmental assessment. And they are currently going out, taking samplings in that 7-mile range of the Willamette River, trying to figure out where the contamination really is, what the hot spots are, and trying to really establish who might be a responsible party under the law. That's where we really come into play as well, because we're the manager of the bed and the bank of the river. We are granting access agreements to this group to do that work. We're actively involved in that. That has taken a fair amount of legal time working with EPA to get those documents put in place that meet the federal standards and meet DQ standards to get that done.
So it would be reasonable to assume that after all of that legal, well, the analysis and the legal work's been done, that there is potential liability there for the state in terms of unclaimed or orphan pollution that's out there that can't be attributed to anyone that is reasonable. The question I have is why is the Common School Trust Fund what is at risk here?
Because the state is the owner of the bed and the banks, and that's part of a common school fund asset, land asset.
So there is something that ties the Common School Trust Fund to the beds and the banks of the rivers?
Yes. That's why with waterway leasing, for example, if you go up to Portland and you see the docks and the houseboats, we collect leases off of those that benefit the Common School Fund.
I guess what I'm not doing is, in my mind, I can't see why it wouldn't be the general fund, for example, that was at risk. Why is it the Common School Trust Fund? And I'm wondering, I guess what isn't clear in my mind is whether the beds and the banks are assets of the state of Oregon or assets of the Common School Trust Fund.
Chair Morgan, I think you hit the most complex legal problem that we're probably facing in the next couple of years to answer that very question. It is clear to us that our legal authority to manage the bed and the banks came from the state legislature in 1904. And with that comes a certain amount of responsibilities that go with that. Who and ultimately will pay for the cost of the cleanup? I would quote what the governor said at the very first Lower Willamette cleanup authority meeting, which is polluters pay. That doesn't mean by the time we get done with all the legal issues that the state may not have some responsibility. And I say the state in the general sense, not particularly DSL or DEQ or Water Resources, any of the state agencies that have a part to play in managing a water body, but the state in general has some responsibility as a state to address that issue. And I think because we're the manager of the bed and the bank, we're going to be kind of front and center on that.
And I think ultimately that will be a policy issue if there is going to be an impact to the state that they'll that I think that you'll have to decide, do you want to have that cost come out of the general fund or where should that come out of? Right now we're trying to play defense and to minimize
state,
it as much as possible.
This is getting way off topic, but I'm really interested in this. When did the state become the owner of the beds and the banks of the Willamette?
Well, we became...
Chair Morgan, February 14th, 1859.
So it came with statehood under the navigability
statutes.
With the equal footing doctrine, the states were given all the bed and the banks of navigable waterways. That's part of the difficult discussion the land board is dealing with now is which waterways are navigable. There are some that were very obvious from the very beginning, like the Columbia and the Willamette River.
So were those rivers actually just designated navigable at statehood?
You know, I'm not exactly sure when those specifically were designated. My guess is that they were assumed to be navigable at statehood because they were used at that time.
Well, I don't want to take the committee's time on this,
maybe
but
John
it
can
is an interesting idea.
He's kind of our navigability expert.
I don't fill this chair as well as my colleague.
Well, not as much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Lilly, Assistant Director, Department of State Lands. The lower reach of the Willamette in the vicinity of Portland, as well as the Columbia River, all the way down to the Astoria, of course, are tidal rivers, T-I-D-A-L, subject to the ebb and flow of tide. By operation of law at statehood, all tidally influenced waters are owned by the states. Of course, tidal influence on the Willamette runs up to Willamette Falls at Oregon City. But throughout the reach of the river in the city of Portland, that's a tidally influenced reach, and therefore it was not needed a declaration by the state to make an ownership claim to the beds and banks of Willamette, and that reach was not necessary.
Okay. Thank you. Yeah, this does sound like the Lawyers' Full Employment Act.
It is definitely the Lawyers' Full Employment Act.
Let's move ahead.
Okay. The next one is POP 106. This supports the statewide bridge repair and economic revitalization program. These are two positions we currently have in the 03-05 biennium that are funded by the Oregon Department of Transportation in support of their statewide bridge repair program. And this is not common school fund money. This comes out. This is payment by ODOT. There is one other position that is general fund, and that is a position that is connected with the economic revitalization team. This is the position that's been absolutely important for the certification of industrial lands and dealing with wetland issues on industrial lands and resolving a number of key economic development concerns that have generated many jobs for the states over the last two years.
Sorry, we're just on a little sidebar here.
The next one, Program Option Package 112, this is one that we've worked with our tenants on. Frankly, we've had security issues in the building. We've had items that have been stolen, computers that have been stolen. We don't have a central receptionist area as you come into the building. And what this position would be funded, most of it would be funded out of an increase in the rent, about an increase of about 8 cents per square foot to be able to have that central lobby area. We've also have had, in the last year, I've had one staff attacked, and we've also had arrests of individuals that have come into the building. So we're hoping that this would help improve the security of the building.
Who else is in there?
Economic development, employment, and OWEB, in addition to ourselves.
Did you look at options for this that didn't involve FTE?
We looked at ways to do it, but I think the most efficient way was going to be able to have everybody contribute to it, or to take one position from, you know, one program or another, or split up a position across all the agencies. And it seemed to be most efficient just to, and this is what the tenants wanted, was to bump up their rent a little bit to be able to accommodate it.
Well, and the issue that we have, of course, is that all of these people pay rent with some form of public money, and so we have the responsibility to try to keep costs down, and we talk a lot about how the largest driver of cost increases, or one of the largest drivers, is the cost of employees. So I was just wondering if there was any discussion around some kind of an alternative here that involved an intercom system or a phone system up to the various offices, and they could buzz people in if they wanted to or not. I'm just curious if there was any attention paid to recognize the issues around security, and we've all been very sensitized to those issues.
Some of it has to do with just the building itself. It's a very open building. So we need to have somebody right there front and center as you come into the door. So it makes it hard to do it by just, you know, buzzing the other floors.
So does the package just involve sitting somebody out there and hoping they can head all these people off, or is there some kind of barriers that are constructed so people have to go in past them?
We've been working with an architect to design a way to be able to funnel people into that receptionist so that it does require that they go to that receptionist before they go into the upper floors.
Representative Shoffer.
Thank you. The tenants, do they pay market rate? How much do you charge them for rent?
My understanding is the rental rates are set by DAS based on a number of things.
Chair Morgan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Pamela Constantopoulos, and I'm the fiscal manager for the Department of State Lands. While DAS sets the uniform rent rate for state agencies, it applies to their buildings. It does not necessarily apply to ours, and we have, in fact, been giving a less than uniform rent rate to our tenants. They've been paying less than what DAS charges for their buildings. The increase that we're proposing of about 8 cents per square foot actually brings us right in line with the DAS uniform rent rate. So we'll be right equal to it.
I would, with this package, like to get some additional information when we go into work session about how this is configured and if there are ways to accomplish the security needs without actually hiring a person to sit out there and do that.
We can provide that information to you. The next program option, package 110, would be to reduce program reliance on the Common School Fund by supporting an increased permit fee, as well as enhancing wetland delineation customer service by reducing processing times. I'd like to kind of take a step back about talking about overall improvements to the removal fill program, because this is just one of a number of improvements that we have made over the last 2 years. We've, as you've seen with our performance measures, we have instituted hard deadlines, and we've met those deadlines for issuing permits. We've increased the use of general authorizations, which are expedited permits. We've provided online viewing of the status of permits so that it's more transparent for those that are doing permits. We've reduced the amount of time that the amount of turnaround it takes to have a completed application. So, for example, now if a resource coordinator sees that there's not a completed application, that coordinator will pick up the phone and talk to the applicant directly to make sure that they get the information then. And as you've seen with the performance measures, we've reduced that time downward significantly. We've also done extensive training throughout the state. We've held around 50 sessions all over the state to talk about the removal fill program, what it is, what the requirements are, what you have to do for the application, with the goal that providing that training will make it easier and more understandable for people. We're also very close to securing streamlining between the Corps of Engineers, the Army Corps of Engineers, and the state through the statewide programmatic general permit, and that'll cover 8 categories. And that'll be, I think, one way to make it easier for people to comply by going through the state and knowing that they're going to meet both Corps and federal ESA requirements. I mentioned to you the economic revitalization team that we're involved with and the work we're doing there on industrial land certifications. And then most recently, Stephanie Halleck and I have initiated a removal fill permit quality improvement program where we have we've brought the agencies together to look at how we can best do this. And I think there's going to be some pretty exciting recommendations coming out of that group. So, you know, this is the adding, kind of going back to this specific POP, one of the things that we heard from the wetland consultants that they were they were concerned about was the long time lag in trying to get wetland delineation reports from the agency. And quite frankly, we're just understaffed in being able to respond to those wetland delineations. They're ones that landowners find very valuable to have the review done by the agency so it can bring them both certainty and predictability when they do their project and know either how to avoid wetlands or what they might need to do with wetlands. We've had a large backlog, and we've had complaints to try to expedite that. We currently don't charge a fee for doing that wetland delineation review, and there was support for adding a fee that would allow that to be expedited. So with that, with the fee package, it includes that. It is also an overall fee increase generally for the state removal fill program, because right now fees cover less than 20% of the cost of the program. This fee would increase it so that it would be about 30% of the cost of the program. There has not...
Where would we find information with the current fee schedule and the revised fee schedule?
Can I ask a question? I found it. I'll get it.
Page 308, where is that, in our budget book? In our budget book, page 308.
Manager?
Representative Dinko.
I had a question about the existing fee for the removal fill program. Can you remind me when the last time that was increased?
It was 1987. And what we've done for the fee increase after talking with the Removal Fill Advisory Committee, which includes a number of the users of the and those interested in the Removal Fill program, is that we increased the fee by basically the inflation rate, 3%, since 1987. So the increase that we have here is basically deals with the inflation. Back at the time that the last fee increase was approved in 1987, the fees covered about 40% of the cost of the program.
There's individual permit fee and renewal fee, the last two categories, and it says varied by schedule for the current fee and the proposed fee, and for both of those categories. Is there any way that we can get more defined information about what the current schedule is and what the proposed increases are for those two categories?
Yes, we can do that. We can show you.
And not, this would be phase three information,
right?
That if we could just get it to Ms. McGlashan, she could get it to us.
I'd be happy to do that. The next program option package is the Wetland Revolving Fund. This is program option package 111, and this would increase the expenditure authority of the revolving fund to $750,000 per biennium. I want to note that this is not common school fund. These are monies that are collected for mitigation projects and mitigation banks. The House Bill 2899 that passed last session and made it easier to use mitigation banks and this type of mitigation has now increased the demand for it. We have about, our current limitation is about $350,000, and we're going to spend all of that in this biennium. The account has about $1.5 million in it right now, so there's more than enough in the account to be able to accommodate the increase in the limitation for this.
And here, are we going to get a budget narrative of 111? Is this, it just goes from 110 to 112.
Yes.
Oh, excuse me. All right, thank you.
If you look under the wetland tab, you'll see it there.
Thank you.
You're missing that one.
There we are. Thank you very much.
I just had a clarification about this. So this is a fee paid in lieu. it goes into this one. You said there's about $1.5 million currently in the fund. So you're asking for an increase, an expenditure increase, and so you will still have that million sitting in there. So I'm just curious. I mean, if this goes to provide a direct service, and you have a greater need than you do currently staff, could you not look at hiring additional staff through, I mean, that's paid, not general fund, but that's directly paid by FAE, correct?
Chair Morgan, Representative Dingfelder, yes, that is not general fund, it's not common school fund monies. These are monies that are paid by developers or individuals for mitigation. We put in $750,000 because that's what we thought we could likely spend in the next biennium for various projects. These are projects that we either buy credits in other wetland mitigation banks, which for the first time with that legislation we were able to buy credits in wetland mitigation banks, or we fund other mitigation projects. This is just another tool to allow people to be able to do their mitigation easily if they can't do it on site.
Possible to provide us with the information for the last biennium on what the fund has been used to buy?
Yes, we can.
And again,
do
that would just be for not this minute, just in for use in the phase three.
We will provide that to you.
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Schaffer.
I want to find out what I did 2 years ago. Is this the $50,000 per acre that we passed out last year that I voted for, and now we want to pay for it?
Yes.
May I follow up, please? And why didn't we put a funding mechanism in it initially in the first place? Why did we wait till now?
There is a funding mechanism. It's just capped at $350,000 currently.
We want to just increase it.
Right. This increases it from last biennium, or the current biennium, we're funded at the level of $350,000. We can't go above that. So this bumps up that limit to $750,000 in recognition that there's increased use of that as a result of House Bill 2899.
Okay, I'm a developer. I need to find some mitigatable land because I'm going to build on a wetland. Why don't I pay the $50,000? And why don't we just wait till they need it and let the developer pay the $50,000? Why should we get involved in all this? I guess is what I'm trying to say. Because I'm not interested in increasing fees this year. I'm just not interested in doing any of that, I'm for the record. Not very many.
Chair Morgan, Representative Schaffer, from member of the committee, I'm sure I understand your question. You know, why should the state get involved in the wetland mitigation banking business?
No, excuse me. Let me clarify. I'm a developer. Let's pretend. And I have some wetland I want to develop on, but I got to go out and find some land to make or create a wetland to mitigate my destroying this wetland through development. I'm the one that's going to need to come up with $50,000 if I need an acre of wetland to replace the half acre or whatever acre I'm. So it's my money. It's already set at $50,000. What are we increasing and why? I'm not putting this all together.
Sometimes, you know, you may be doing a development where you're not in the area of where a wetland mitigation bank is, and so your options are either to try to do that on site or to do it yourself, or if you just, you know, don't want to deal with that, you can pay money into this, and then we will take care of the mitigation that needs to be done either by funding other projects or by funding or by buying a credit in a mitigation bank.
I've given you my $50,000. What do we need to increase something for? The money's already coming from the developer.
I think that the concept here is around the expenditure limitation, that what we're doing is raising the amount of money that they can churn in this fund. So it would, I think, be a reflection of the increased use of off-site mitigation that this funds by your new career as a developer, people in like-minded pursuits as that. So this, I don't think, involves an increase in funds. It just reflects the need for the legislature to give the agency permission to move more money through the program because more people will be using the program.
Thank you very much for being
here. Done a great job.
Thank you for your patience.
Thank you.
The next two program option packages deal with the South SLU. And in the first program option package, 107, is to continue six federally funded positions that support research, education, and facility maintenance. These are positions that we already have. They're limited duration positions, and in order to continue them as they're federally funded, we need to be able to have the expenditure authority to be able to proceed with to continue these positions in the next biennium. They deal with coastal training, volunteer program coordination, maintenance, monitoring, and habitat monitoring and system-wide restoration or system-wide monitoring on a biological sense. The second one, POP 109, increases fiscal accountability through upgrading a management position and support staff. As there have been more staff at South SLU, as we've gotten more grants from the federal government, as well as other grants for funding, it has become more complex with the number of grants that we have and the different requirements. And I believe this would tighten the fiscal accountability there by upgrading a position. The current position is an office manager and doesn't have hiring and firing authority, and we would then be allowing that person to be able to supervise and coordinate the administrative functions. And the other thing that this one does is we've had a recommendation from an audit that NOAA has done on the program that said that there are several core positions of South SLU: the manager, the research coordinator, the education coordinator, and the stewardship coordinator, that they all want to see funded out of state funds. And the research coordinator has not been. So this one would then satisfy the audit that NOAA has given us.
He said NOAA doesn't want to see state funds. Those state funds that you're being used are common school funds?
Yes. I do want to also mention that in the memorandum that I gave here, I gave to you today, there is toward the end of that big packet, there are minutes from the South SLU National Estuary Management Commission. And if you turn toward the end of that, and about where it says, beginning on, it says page 13 through pages 21, that's the that was the recommendations from an technical advisory group that came up with ideas of how we could reduce dependence on the Common School Fund. I've also just today talked with Tim Wood, who is the director of the Department of Parks, to look at how we might see if there's ways that Parks might be able to help with the funding of South SLU as well. And we will be reporting back to you over that, and we're going to be working on that over the interim. The next program option package would enhance information systems and data processing. This does add a federally funded position at South SLU. Does not involve any Common School Fund money. They're getting involved increasingly using geographic information systems and the kind of research that they're doing. Okay, can you hear me? Yes, with that, the lawnmower. With the geographic information system and other types of research that they're doing, the data transmission is simply inadequate. And this would allow an improvement of the information systems and provide them the support for data systems that they don't currently have. The ending balance,
Common School Fund, as you can see, is a little bit different than some of the other funds. The current balance of the Common School Fund as of the end of February was $919 million, but if you want to get more details on the vacancy calculation, it was in the summary binder under tab 10, and then there's ending balance detail under the revenue tab in the budget binder.
One of the things that I am interested in taking a look at is not so much the ending balance on the fund, but the earnings. And so I'm wondering if it would be possible to break down the investments that you have the fund in and the returns on those investments, say, over the last, I don't know, maybe three or four biennium. Is that possible?
Oh, yes. That's it. In fact, we can get you, say, the most, the last quarter report that we have from the treasurer's office that tells you exactly what kind of funds we're invested in and the returns that we've had on those funds and how it's allocated.
Okay, and who makes the decision on the types of investments that the monies will be invested in?
Oregon Investment Council does that, along with the treasurer's office.
So would there be a different rate of return on the Common School Fund than there would be on, say, the PERS money that's invested?
There could be, depending on what the allocation of revenue is. I think PERS may have some other types of investments than the Common School Fund has. Like, they may have more real estate investment than what we have. Now, we have our own real estate, but they, I think, have actually invested commercially into real estate in PERS. I think it would be best to maybe have the treasurer's office come in and speak specifically about the differences in investing policies between PERS and other funds.
Could we have a discussion with the co-chairs over this? Because I think that the committee members would benefit from some understanding of how these are invested and the rate of return relative to other funds that the state invests, if it would be possible for us to get the treasurer in here to have that discussion.
The question also arises, why is it different? I mean, why is it different?
We'll ask
the treasurer that.
Okay.
That would...
Let's go ahead.
The next several pages are all on legislation, and if it would help the committee in saving time, given that we have people here to testify, I have a copy from the... that was supposed to be delivered. I'll get you copies of the most recent legislative report from the landlord.
Got it?
Uh-huh. I do have it. And so you could look at this report that I just provided to the land board on Tuesday. And if you have any questions about legislative, because I think some of what you may have had there from phase one is out of date, and this would give you a better update of that. And then if you have any specific questions about any of the legislation affecting the agency, I can answer that at
that would be
whatever
great.
Your convenience.
We could take this up in the phase three part of the discussion if members have questions.
That would be great. So that really ends my presentation for the agency.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Okay, we'll now go into the public testimony phase of this, and I have a couple of people that came here from more than 100 miles away, so we will hear from them first. The first one is Rich Hamill from Coos Bay, and after that, Mr. Wilbur Turnier. So, Mr. Hamill, if you could come forward. And if you have written testimony that you wish to submit to us, we'd be very glad to make it part of the permanent record.
I have submitted that. Presented before the meeting started.
Oh, okay.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I have one copy, so I didn't have time to make copies.
Oh, okay. We'll take care of that
after the meeting to get it to your office.
Thank you. Welcome.
Chair Morgan and members of the subcommittee. For the record, I'm Rich Hamill. I reside in Bandon, Oregon. I'm here to support the operations of the South Slough Reserve. I'm a member of the South Slough Management Commission, which is the seven-member commission created by the legislature in 1974. I am appointed by the governor as the in the position of public at large commission. I'm also the treasurer of the Friends of South Slough Reserve, Incorporated, which is a nonprofit corporation partnership with the reserve to support the operations of the reserve. The Friends of South Slough and the Management Commission both support the budget presented to you in the last 2 days, including the option packages outlined in the governor's recommended budget. The mission of the reserve is to improve our understanding of and ability to manage estuaries throughout our state and the region. The reserve was established as an outdoor laboratory to support research and educational programs focused on estuaries. I'm happy to report that this program is a valuable asset to this state and to our nation. I believe that the value will increase significantly as our population grows and we find greater and greater need to pay attention to the food chain associated with our estuaries. The South Slough Management Commission is keenly aware that in 2003, your committee charged DSL with the task of exploring ways to decrease the reliance of this program on the Common School Fund. This has been a real challenge. The Commission and the South Slough Advisory Group have discussed this directive at formal meetings, and they have taken action to demonstrate that we really are taking the directive seriously. I will only address three possible solutions or items that we've discussed. During the 1999 session, the legislature authorized the reserve to establish a federally funded public involvement coordination position. This position has worked to expand voluntary participation in South Slough programs. In addition to focus on recruiting and training traditional volunteers to augment the capacity of state and federally supported tasks, the reserve has worked to form partnerships with social service programs on the South Coast, such as vocational rehabilitation, welfare-to-work programs, and juvenile justice programs. During the 2001-2003 season, these volunteers contributed 13,300 hours with an added value of over $228,000 in labor to the reserve. The Friends of South Slough have also donated $15,000 to the reserve so far this budget period. The modest level of state funding leverages federal support and provides a direct benefit to the school children of our state. The majority of the staff at the reserve is supported fully or in part with federal funds, which could only be happen with the funding provided by the state for leverage. The Management Commission has worked with DSL to develop a legislative concept to vest the Management Commission with the authority to establish fees for programs and services offered by South Slough Reserve. The legislative concept is now known as Senate Bill 91, which is currently being reviewed during this session of the legislature. The Management Commission has unanimously endorsed this bill. Thank you very much for providing me this opportunity to speak to you.
Questions or comments from the committee members?
Madam Chair, thanks for coming up this morning.
We appreciate you taking the time. That's quite a undertaking. I call forward Mr. Truniak. He's very happy to have her come forward.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate being able to testify in front of you today. And my name is Wilbur Trunick. I live in Florence, Oregon. My profession is a wetland consultant, work on beaches and dune consulting too. And there is such a thing as poor DSNL, all these agencies wrestling with their budget. And by the way, I 100% support at least the wetland portion of the budget because I don't know much about the other. However, there's some real problems out there in the real world of where I work and where the other wetland consultants work. Before we get to the bad news, I'd like to talk about good news. And it's a real, this is a project down at Charleston in Coos Bay. This is only part of it. This is about half of the work that I've had to do on this project. That project's going to be a $300 million project. We just about got the permits, both permits. On the way, over the past year, the client that I'm working for has lost two sets of investors. Why? Because it took too long. People who really want to invest money in this state don't want to wait around for it. They would like to get it done. Is it the fault of DSO? It certainly is not. DSO staff has worked with us 100% right straight through on this project. We've had a tremendous amount of problems with the Corps of Engineers. And to be fair to everybody, imagine 22 acres of site where all of these condominiums are going to be built. It's an old sawmill site, and it was on a dredge fill. So when we started to dig the test holes, 5-inch planks, solid, blanket of them over 22 acres. That makes it difficult. Janet Moreland came down and assisted along with Jim Gothward from the Corps, and we were able to work through the delineation. And then when we got into mitigation, Bob Lobdell was absolutely a gem in working through this whole project. Does that mean he gave us everything we wanted? He sure didn't. He's most of the DSL staff is that way. So this project, I think, is a testament to the fact that the DSL program can work and things can go forward and you can do something positive. They're going to have the 223 condominiums. There will be an ocean dock for tour boats coming in. And marina, just a real shot in the arm for Coos County. By the same token, I'm working down in Curry County at Brookings. That is extremely difficult. You go down there, you can't find any mitigation at all. It's almost not there, period. And the town's exploding. They're building on hills that I can't even believe they're building on it. They're so steep. We need a mitigation bank there in the worst way. And I'll be going down looking for something here pretty soon. On the other thing, on the Central Oregon coast, and I live in Florence, and imagine this now, and the reason I'm bringing this up is that we just definitely need to have a satellite office of DSL on the coast somewhere, whether it's Newport or Florence or what it is, because DSL is going to be faced with a huge amount of permits coming in. And the reason I say that is that Lahani Shores, that's a oceanfront project that I worked out by Driftwood Shores in Florence. A lot, 5 years ago, you could have bought it for $64,000. Last week, it was advertised for $509,000. But the problem is that in Western Lane County, where something like 85% owned by some agency or another, the other 15% the real estate pay will have to work with, they've used up the uplands. Now they're going to start moving into everything that's going to have wetlands on them. The problems will have to be permits. And that's true up and down the whole coast, whether it's Bannon or where it's at. So I hope somewhere along the line in the future we have consideration of putting somebody on the coast so they don't have to drive all the way down there hours and hours and hours and come back. And let's see. The other pipeline, I worked on the Coos County natural gas pipeline. And your staff, the DSL staff, told me I was crazy. I should be examined for even touching it. We did the 8 miles from Myrtle Point to Coquille. And we worked with Bob Rose because there were lots of alleged violations on the first part. Lo and behold, we got it all through and saved the county $300,000 in one field. They didn't have to drill under it. So it was very successful. I think all these things can be addressed that way if you have reasonable people. My big disappointment continues to be, and it will until it ends, and it's a real problem with every one of us working in the field on the coast. Why should I apply for a permit, my client says, when the Forest Service wipes out wetlands every day and no permits? And again, at the All Events Center, when Ed Becker, the ranger of the Oregon Dunes, was asked, why didn't you get a permit? And they're going to wipe out 276 acres of very important wetlands. And what was his answer? We thought about it, but we decided it would take too long. We have a real problem trying to treat our Oregon residents with the idea that you have to get a permit. Federal government doesn't have to. They can do anything they want to. And they even get awards for some of the work that they do, which is good work. But they still should be under the permit program, both by the Corps and the other. We talked about the mitigation bank at DSL. I used to use that. I can't use it anymore. Why can't I? Because if I have something twice the size of this room, and of course any more you can get away with, probably without any mitigation on something that small, Corps says no. We're not going to let you use that DSL mitigation bank, period. By the same token, I get this letter from one of them saying you could donate money to Nature Conservancy Project. Now, I haven't tried that with DSL. I don't know whether they accept that or not. But it doesn't make sense to run around digging little mosquito ponds for a small mitigation site when we could pay into the DSL bank, and that's what I would like to do, and I think most people would. So that's one of the other things that's really thing. The other thing that really is bad in my area is violations. We got them everywhere, and nobody does anything about it. We've got one right next to 126. You drive right by it. And asked the guy, one of my clients did, you're filling wetlands. He says, you bet I am. He said, the guy up the street filled them. You know, nothing was done. Why should I do anything? That's going on right now today. And north of the town, we did a delineation for a man up there, and there was a considerable acreage, and we identified lots of wetlands. And he got the delineation, and he looked at it, and he said, I don't like this. So did he send it to DSL for concurrence? No, he kept it. It's his report. I really can't give it to anybody because he paid for it. He sold it to somebody else. What did they do? They went in and wiped out the wetlands. And why were they able to do that? Because there were a lot of brush there and nobody could see what was going on. But the neighbors all knew what was in there. They knew about the delineation, everything. And then to top it all off, my son, who works for the contractor, told me last week, he said, Dad, I was in there for 2 days, and he said, I was doing nothing but pushing out your wetland flags. And we need to have somebody that will pay attention to the violations and stomp on them and stomp on them hard. And again, I'd like to propose that, and I don't know whether the state can do it or who can do it. Maybe it's the city. The contractor who knowingly violates the wetland law over and over and over again and then hands it to the property owner and says, well, it's not my problem. It's your property. You're the one that's in trouble. That contractor should be penalized some way. Even in our own state government, ODOT, they get their permits. The county gets their permits, but not the Forest Service. So, some of the, you talked about environmental cleanups. At the Bay Point Estates down in Charleston, Imagine, she didn't go begging for somebody to give her the money to do that cleanup. She did it herself, $180,000-some. It was a massive pile of sulfur. Hauled it all out, cleaned it up. When I first went down there, there was a pristine forest right next between the highway and her project. And they were going to develop. I talked her into leaving it, and lots of wetlands, she did. There's really responsible people out there, but we really need some help. And I would make a plea that you're wasting the talents of Steve Morrow when you make him a coordinator. He was the best person I ever worked with on violation. Super, super good. There should be some way that we have a violation officer in DSL that can work on these kind of things, and we can take care of them. Other than that, probably can't go over here for the next 10 years. Now I'm 79, but I'll try. And I thank you.
Thank you so much. I call forward, let's see, Mark Knopf. Did you have questions?
Well, I was going to ask Austin Park. As far as the lands, we haven't had any control, I suppose.
There was a clarify that, shouldn't we have?
Yeah. That's decent.
Good afternoon.
Thank you, Chair Morgan, the rest of the committee. My name is Mark Knopf. I live near Rickreall, Oregon. I'm a full-time farmer, been farming for 30 years. And in 2000, I put in a wetland mitigation bank. And I'm kind of here and speaking on behalf of wetland mitigation banking. I know some of you are fairly familiar with it. Maybe some of you aren't. I think it's a huge benefit for all user groups within the state. It provides a great option for developers to be able to have an option to mitigate where they're short. It provides mitigations in larger sites that are high value to provide much higher quality wetlands and small postage stamp types mitigations that typically take place. It also provides mitigation in areas that are outside most of the urban areas where you have infrastructure and the other parts of development, you know, necessary for development that enhance the ability to develop in those areas. And it also reduces the need to move out into high-value farmland to develop if you're able to, you know, mitigate some of the wetland areas within the already developed areas. So it provides a lot of benefits. For myself personally, what it's done, I know one of the concerns about wetlands mitigation banks, one of them has been that you're taking farmland out of production and turn it into wetlands. As a farmer, one of the biggest problems I faced, and is typical of all agriculture as far as being able to survive farming, is overproduction. We're right now in the legislature, I know there's bills looking at alternative crops, biofuels, other type of things to try to provide other agricultural options and to keep agriculture viable. Mitigation banks, as I look at it, by restoring wetlands on our property, it's an alternative crop that we've been able to utilize. We've taken some of the wetter soils, they're less productive farm grounds, been able to restore wetlands on them, meet a you know, important need of developers, transportation, other users, at the same time make our farming operation much more viable because we have another alternative rather than just the farm cycle, which is pretty volatile. And so that's been a big benefit, as well as the larger size wetlands that we're able to restore that are in, like in our case, CFU zones. You have long-term bufferings that protect these wetlands from outside influences to a much higher degree than if mitigations take place closer to the urbanized areas. So that's some of the benefits. I support the budgets of DSL in regards to wetlands, which is the area I'm familiar with. The option package, both 110 and 111, the 110, which would provide additional staffing to help with delineations and speed up the wetland process, as well as the 111, which would increase the limit that the revolving fund is allowed to expend in a year. And anyway, that's basically what I wanted to say, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Senator Nelson.
thank you. Thank you for coming up and testifying. You know, the previous speaker was talking about wetlands and issues with federal. I assume the federal government. Do you have any of those same issues where federal government is doing one thing and state you have to do different?
In the actual mitigation bank program, we are authorized as a bank both with DSL and the Corps of Engineers. And someone that uses our bank, they have to have the permits approved by both DSL and the Corps. I mean, if they bought credits from us to meet one need and not the other, they still couldn't develop. And so they, as far as the actual mitigation banks, the Corps is working to allow the use of those banks, but you have to be within the service area of a bank and able to do that. As far as the revolving fund, which if there isn't a bank service area within the area that you're impacting as a developer and you have to use that fund, I know that isn't recognized by the Corps of Engineers, and so it's not acceptable to get a permit. But as far as an actual mitigation bank with a defined service area, that is an option that the Corps allows as well as DSL.
Do you see any of the violations as the previous speaker alleged to? Or?
You know, I couldn't speak to that. I'm such a narrow focus of that. I'm as initially a farmer and someone out that's restoring wetlands, I'm looking at it from the standpoint, I mean, I'm just in that one small area, and, you know, I'm not exposed to what, you know, developers or individuals may be doing as far as impacting wetlands. So it's something I don't really have any knowledge of. No.
Give me an idea of how this actually works for you. Do you get a yearly payment for your bank? Do you get a monthly payment? Do you get a one-time payment?
That's a good question.
You select a certain amount to put in, and then how would you actually do?
Right. When we first became interested in it, we saw an article in the paper. It was actually in 1999 of one of the first banks that went in. It kind of piqued our interest, both from the standpoint. I started out, I got a degree in wildlife science, and then I started farming, and so I had interest in that area. We had a lot of wet farmland, and we'd put other wetlands in starting in 96 using the Wetland Reserve Program, which is the federal program. So we had interest in restoring wetlands as well as experience and an ideal place to be able to do that restoration. So in order to get into the program, we hired a couple wetland consultants and expended a fair amount of time coming up with a proposal that ultimately was accepted by DSL and the Corps to start a bank. And in that process involves putting together and getting approval for a service area. In addition to DSL and the Corps, you have DEQ, EPA, ODF, and DIB, and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service also sit on the mitigation bank review team and go over the plans and the proposal. So there's quite a process involved. And so we had a fair amount of expenditures just coming up with a plan for the proposed site that we wanted to restore. Once that was approved, we funded all the expenses for the restoration, the planting. There's major monitoring that goes along to demonstrate that you are meeting the objectives that we have established in the proposal we put together. And our payments then come from our funding, comes from once we meet certain performance standards, we have credits released based on the degree of restoration that took place on our plan. And when we meet these benchmarks, credits are released, which we then can sell to developers, or ODOT is a large user of when they're doing, you know, new highways and that type of thing. But when they have a need to mitigate, one option available is to use a bank. And so we're strictly dependent on meeting performance standards and then having developers or other users having needs and coming to us and buying credits from us. And so there's quite a bit of risk involved, but if you can succeed in restoring the wetlands adequate enough, there's a potential rewards. And it kind of as a farmer, we're kind of gamblers anyway, and so I didn't see it as any greater risk than the farm cycle that we're already dealing with.
Last follow-up question. Thank you for the explanation. I appreciate it.
Welcome.
When you sell a credit,
yes,
do you get a one-time payment for that, or is it a payment that continues?
Yeah, it's a one-time payment.
But you have to maintain the wetland forever then.
That's correct. And so you have to look at it from the standpoint, once you have sold the credit, that is it as far as any residual, you know, return from that. So that's one of the factors, too, where mitigation is more expensive sometimes, too, because you aren't looking at just an annual rental payment or something like that. It's a one term. And when someone buys a credit from us, their wetland liability has been transferred to us, and they're free to do their development, and we have taken on that wetland management obligation then.
But is that then pass on if you sell the farm to somebody else? That pass on then?
As it currently exists, we have a restrictive covenant that says it will stay perpetually in wetlands, and we're in the process of putting a conservation easement on the property as well, which providing funding for we're working with the Wetland Conservancy, which would be responsible for making sure that the wetland management takes place for perpetuity.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you taking time to come and talk to us.
Thank you for letting me testify.
Call Malia Capellas. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chair, representatives. My name is Malia Capellas. I'm president of Pacific Hydrogeology. We're an environmental consulting firm that specializes in hydrogeology, water rights, and wetlands work. And to give you some background, I should have put my glasses on. I also want to point out that I, myself and my girlfriend, we were part of one of the governor's pilot projects that was performed. One of them was in Lebanon to help with economic development in that area. We delineated, I forget how many hundreds of acres of wetlands. The program has been successful, and Lebanon is now looking at additional of at least 600 new jobs in that area. And it was nice to be able to be an active part of that, and it also brought work to three very small consulting firms, and we really benefited from that. But what I'm here to testify about today is DSL's fee bill, and I really want to tell you that they really do need some type of a flat fee for delineation reviews. And
if I could interrupt, we haven't posted to take testimony on the fee bill, and so we can't do that until we have that posted.
Oh, I was thought this was all today, too.
Today
I'm sorry.
Is just the budget bill for the department, which is House Bill 5054.
Okay, and that doesn't include the wetland delineation fee or any of that stuff?
Correct.
Okay, well, I will. I can shift my testimony since I'm here, and I will be back.
If you have written testimony, we'd be glad to receive that.
No, I haven't had time to prepare any written testimony, but I can fall on what everybody else has been testifying about. We have used Mud Slough Mitigation Bank, and they do provide a very valuable service. And one of the more important things about wetland mitigation banks is they provide a very large area of wetlands, so you get the diversity of wildlife habitat and the connectedness that you do not get with these little isolated piecemeal wetland delineations that you try to do on-site. So they do provide a very, very valuable service. Many times the people who run those banks, they're not doing it to make a lot of money. They're doing it for a love of the resource. And it does give economic value to land that otherwise could not be farmed or would not have much value. So, yes, there is a one-time fee when you buy a mitigation bank credit, but that's land earning money that before it maybe never would have earned money. So there is an economic benefit there. As far as the department and enforcement, yes, because of budget cuts and everything, Division of State Lands is really handicapped in trying to do enforcement, and I would have to agree there's a lot of areas out there that enforcement's not happening and they would like to. And above that, I guess I need to find out when the fee bill with all of that stuff is going to be on.
We have not yet scheduled any of the bills beyond the basic budget bill, so the best thing probably is to check the legislative website and look at the schedules for the committees.
Okay.
And does anyone want to ask any questions or make any comments? Senator Nelson.
Yeah, I should have asked part of the other folks, too. How does the appraisal work in this thing when you put your land in? Do you have any idea?
I mean, an appraisal as far as a mitigation bank goes?
Yeah, if you have a parcel of land you want to put it in the bank, I mean, how does that process work?
I'm not very familiar with it, but the procedure that they have is whenever you impact a wetlands, there's a ratio of how you have to mitigate. And so when they set up a bank, they also look at that ratio. And there's certain things, if you're creating wetlands versus enhancing wetlands, you get more credit if you are creating than if you just come in and enhance something that's already existing. And so when they're going through the banking process, Division of State Lands and Army Corps of Engineers will sit down and they will evaluate the different types of wetlands this mitigation bank is going to be able to mitigate for. Can it do riverine? Can it do valley slope wetlands? Or is it kind of like shallow, open prairie meadow wetlands? Okay, and so then you get classified according to those different types of wetlands, and then the DSL and Army Corps then figure out how many credits, based on what you have to do to create that mitigation bank, you're going to have available to sell. So there's kind of an integrated... Does that answer your question? It's kind of a give-and-take process of evaluating the site, what needs to be done to the site to create the wetlands, and then proceeding with it and then evaluating the quality of it.
Do you see any of this violation as the one man was talking about, that people are just going out and destroying wetlands? Or?
It happens all the time. I mean, I run into it constantly. People go, well, that's not a wetlands. What do you mean? You know, and because in most people's minds, a wetlands is a pond. And they don't realize that there's a lot of wetlands out there that are not ponds. Or it's a county ditch. They don't realize that that county ditch just so happens to also be a stream. And it just happens that the county has diverted the stream into the ditch to get to another river. And so there's a lot of education that needs to happen to help people really understand what wetlands are. And there's a lot of developers out there whose attitudes are they could care less. They want to go through with their development. And, oh, it's just a little wetlands. I'm going to ignore it. I was involved in a project where they built a townhome on top of a spring and didn't bother to put in adequate footing drainage, and we got into all kinds of mold, mildew, and you name it problems. Just because, yeah, and that was the last one they developed because it was the wettest site. You know, we had another case where another developer built a duplex, and half of it was on a peat bog, and he didn't put the proper footings all the way down. So the part of the duplex that was built over the peat bog suddenly, you know, sunk. You know, so this happens. You know, so this is happening all the time. I mean, we're happy to work with developers, and we're always glad when they call us out there and ask us, please delineate the wetlands, please work with us. We don't want to impact the wetlands, so we're going to design our development around those. I mean, there are those developers who are out there, but there's a lot of them who consider that a nuisance, just a waste of money. It's just going to cost them time and money, and they want to avoid it. And they know, and I've talked with people, well, if I get out there with a cat and I destroy the plants, then it's not a wetlands anymore. And so they think, well, if they wipe out the plants so you can't see what's growing there, then they're not going to get in trouble. Well, you know, that doesn't always work. But it takes people out there reporting. It takes DSL to have the time to properly do their jobs to bring this all into perspective. And what I'm going to be testifying on when it gets scheduled, I think, is the solutions to really help DSL start getting back on top of things in because of the cuts that they've had to deal with.
Come up with a definition of wetlands yet, or is that we're still using the vague one that we heard yesterday?
you'd perhaps want to consult with the DSL gurus in the second row there.
Yeah, or I can answer. Would you like to know what the definition of a wetlands is? Okay. Basically, the definition of a wetlands is an area that stays wet enough, long enough into the growing season that it influences the soils and the plants so that your soils develop what's called hydric characteristics, and there are specific things that we look at that tells us a soil is hydric, and greater than 50% of the plants that are dominant there are plants that prefer to grow in a wet area. So it's based on three legs of a stool. You've got to have hydrology present long enough, which in Oregon is March, mid-March, sometimes into April. If you've got an area that's wet enough, and that doesn't mean water on the surface, that also means water fairly shallow within 10, or it's models within 10 inches and water within 12 inches. So you know, people go out there thinking, well, I don't have a wetlands, I don't see standing water. But if you dug a hole down, you would find mottled soils within 10 inches, or you might find water within 12 inches if you're there at the right time of the year that you're in the growing season. And that's a very small window. So when we go out and we do wetland delineations, we're making the decisions most of the time not just on the hydrology, but we're looking at the soils to tell us the story of what the hydrology is, and we're looking at the plants to tell us what's going on. And if you lose plants, the only thing you have left is soils. So does that answer it? Yeah, and you have to have...
Is that same definition applied in all the areas of the country?
That's Army Corps Engineers 1985 manual, and that's pretty much standard of what everybody uses.
Questions or comments?
Thank you so much for taking your time and coming to talk to us. We appreciate it. And I will call Chuck Bennett and Lori Wimmer Whalen forward, please.
Is this a school bill?
Oh,
I think they're talking about wetlands.
Madam Chair, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Our interest is not hydrated soil. We're interested in the pay dirt here.
Should have guessed.
Kind of put us in context. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm a member of the Common School Fund Beneficiaries Advisory Committee. We are a group of beneficiaries to the Common School Fund, who represent those who are beneficiaries. And we've had an opportunity to come before this committee before and tell you just what a great job DSL has been doing in working with us to assist us both, I think, in understanding the Common School Fund, how it's derived, how it's invested, how it's distributed, and the various activities that go on at the Division of State Lands. It has included formation of the Beneficiaries Advisory Committee. They have appointed education beneficiaries to the Rangeland Health Assessment Committee, the Grazing Fee Advisory Committee, and the Asset Management Plan Steering Committee, which happens to be the committee that I serve on. They have kept us well informed throughout the past couple of years since we last were here. The communications with DSL, I think it's exemplary in terms of the relationship that can exist between a beneficiary group and a state government agency that manages the asset that benefits the group that's interested. We're here in general support of this budget, as well as specifically the decision packages you're looking at. We realize that the agency's budget is an aggressive budget. It talks about some substantial additions to their program. That's what's needed. They have, I think, a visionary look with the State Land Board at doubling the Common School Fund within the next 10 years, and it's going to take investment to do that. Each of the investment proposals, including addition to the rangeland management program, the waterway leasing property management, costs of maintaining and improving those rangelands, 103 that has the increase in the long-term the positions to intensify land management activities, which we believe is an attempt to rebalance their real estate portfolio, as well as the other portions of their budget, are really targeted on to increasing the Common School Fund. And that's what we've been asking them to do, and they've been sort of, I think, leading the charge, and it's really been an excellent relationship. We're real pleased with what's going on here, so we hope you'll support their budget proposal. Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Krieger.
Chuck, there's been the discussion that the chair has had, we had last session, regarding the amount of money that goes to South SLU to support them that's not going. Can you address that? How you feel about that, and do you believe we need to be continuing to help them move towards being more sufficient without using those dollars?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, thank you. Yes, there is a fee bill in, or there is a bill in that increases South SLU use payments. I can't remember if it's a fee bill or how it's worded. I was looking at it this morning that I think assists in that, and I think they're headed in that direction. And the South SLU, I've had some problems with, I think I expressed them last session too, that this is a common school fund cost without kind of the broad benefit. But in learning more about it, I think that it is one of those assets of the common school fund that over time, and probably into the future, will begin to pay for itself, is a really valuable South Coast asset, and ultimately regional asset. And its educational value, I think, is probably unmeasured at this point. I mean, I think they're doing a great job, but there's a lot more there. So I've had kind of a change of heart on this as I've learned more. It's like anything else. I think as you learn more, you sort of begin to get a different perspective. And I think it's one of those that we'll watch over the next few years and see how it goes. But certainly if the and I use the term fee bill because I can't remember what it was precisely, but if the fee bill's approved and they begin to pick up some more of their own costs, I think that would be particularly helpful.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, committee members. For the record, Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the 43,000 members of the Oregon Education Association, and you have my written testimony. So in the interest of brevity, let me just say I echo a lot of what my colleague has just said to you. We believe that the Department of State Lands has done a really great job of helping get our attention with respect to this resource. And in a climate of diminishing resources for public education, we, of course, are coming to rely more and more on the local revenue that's distributed through the Common School Fund, and are grateful for the good stewardship of this organization with respect to how they manage these lands. And, you know, it does seem probably a little odd, too, that education advocates would be in a natural resources subcommittee hearing, but they really have helped us understand that there is an intersection point, just as Senator Nelson always reminds us in the education subcommittee of Ways and Means, that there is an intersection point between the natural resources and the education budget. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
What's your comments?
I have a comment, I guess. Yes. And it kind of comes from our meeting last night in Portland. I mean, we basically, our structure is broken in some manner, shape, or form. We're not able to fully fund these projects, but it bothers me that we can continue to grow these agencies. And I don't know the answer. I guess a lot of more goes to the Department of Education, or they want more data so they can tell us how better we are to fund our schools. But I remember that one fellow last night was saying basically, well, you know, I'm a single father, I have three children, I'm trying to get them through school, and if you raise the tuition on me, I said, I might be in the prison system. So sometimes I think we're missing, you know, where you want to be, the prison system, you want to be the education system. You know, where are we sticking our money? I really think the tough decision we have is, we got to stick that money back there. What's going to make the most difference? And I see where you're coming from, but you know, we just continue to grow government, and I don't know that we really help out the folks that I heard testify last night. I don't know how it applies to this, but that's kind of what I've been thinking about all day long.
Senator Bates, you look like you want to say.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, this is a new budget for me, and a lot of a new concept. But really, what I'm seeing here is a portfolio, and it's a portfolio which you have to decide on a very subjective basis where you get the most bang for your buck in very simple terms. Do you want to sell off certain lands and put them into other investments? Is it better long term, 1,500 years from now, to keep certain lands and keep investing in them by managing them and get return from them also? And I don't really have an answer to that. I think your thoughts of having somebody from the Treasury Department and the people who actually do the investments come in and talk to us about this is very, very thoughtful and helpful. I kind of like to know, in a better way, where Department of State Lands is really going. I think clearly they've got some pieces of land that they should never give up. They're real gems for lots of reasons. Others, it seems questionable to me that maybe those should be converted into other forms of investments which might serve a better purpose over the next 10 years and actually manage to double this thing. So it's a tough call. It's a tough call. It's a decision we all make about our investments. But there's people a lot smarter than I am, and I'd like to see what they have to say. So I think your thoughts of bringing somebody in from the other department is very good.
Also, now that we're waxing philosophical here, just to continue that, find ourselves in situations where we find solutions that work from the fiscal perspective, but they're politically impossible to implement. So,
Manager, I would say they're not politically impossible. I'd say we lack the political will to do it.
Well,
I'm talking about cutting down timber and milling lumber in Oregon, the best place in the world to do it, and we ain't doing it enough.
And with that, I thank you very much for taking time out of your schedules to come talk to you, and I call Chris, Bingham, Associated Oregon Counties, and Glenn Stonebrook.
They don't know more than I do.
Don't worry about it. I'm finding my level of skill and ability.
When you bring the Treasury Department in, you bring in personally behind them to do the investments and then take off.
Well, we'll tell them what we want to do, which is what I want to know is why the trust fund is invested the way that it is and what kind of returns it's gotten over time. And is the way it's been invested that we generate more and where it began?
And I want those questions, but I also want the question to ask you. We have parcels of land that we might well be better off having sold, turning to private land, put that money into investments.
Well, were you here for the analysis on the Elliott?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, clearly that one is that unless you can negotiate a substantially better habitat conservation plan, it's better off to sell it. But the political reality.
Yeah, but there might be other pieces that aren't quite as volatile as that.
That's true. Mr. Bam, why don't you begin? We have your testimony in front of us now.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, thank you for this opportunity to testify. My name is Chris Bam. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties County Road Program. I'm their environmental coordinator. I've submitted written testimony supporting House Bill 5045. I am here speaking on behalf of the Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors. They go by the acronym OASIS, and I'm going to use that in this testimony. OASIS members maintain and construct county roads for public access and commerce. Our members believe that having our work reviewed when it's in sensitive areas is critical and important. And so we submit a number of removal fill permits in a given year. And so we're a big user of DSL's programs and their services. And I'll mention a couple of those services here in a minute. We support funding that will allow DSL to do their work efficiently and effectively. We feel they have the capacity and the talent to do that. We value three programs in particular that DSL administers, and that is their removal fill program. We've used heavily their resource coordinators. We ask them to come out in the field at our sites where we're proposing to do work to meet with us in advance of our doing an application. In doing that, the resource coordinators help us to deal with problems before we get to the application process. This saves us time and money in that we don't have permits held up because we're missing something or we're not considering a particular impact. And we value this service, and we hope to see that's funded in the future. We also value the wetland determinations and delineations. This service is critical for us to determine whether or not the work we do is impacting a resource that they have jurisdiction over. And so as we see it now, that service could use additional capacity. There's a number of wetland determinations that are held up because they don't have the ability to do the review that's required. We also value their wetland mitigation banking program. We see that in the near future, counties could use this service to cut down on our costs on mitigating for the impacts that we do due to road construction or road mitigation. Oftentimes, our impacts are very small, less than a quarter of an acre. To do those mitigations cost-effectively, it's better done off-site. We find that doing mitigations off-site aren't as successful, and we believe that if we had a bank, a wetland set aside in an area surrounded by additional wetlands, that we'd be better off if we invested our mitigation dollars in that bank as opposed to doing a mitigation either on-site or off-site on our own. And it also has a greater ecological value, so we get a better ecological bang for our mitigation dollar. We feel that DSL, if given more resources or given current resources, could provide the service that we've seen them provide in the recent past, which is which we believe is to be a valuable service. The county road systems are regulated by a variety of state and federal agencies, and we find that among those agencies, DSL's service stands out. They do an excellent job at customer service. They do a commendable job at evaluating whether or not their service is on an upward trend or a downward trend. Not all agencies do that, and we feel that DSL is an excellent government agency in terms of the service they provide. I mentioned their availability for pre-design and pre-application consultations. I constantly hear from our members that this is a valuable resource, and we'd like to see that continue. We also realize that DSL's program, the removal fill program, streamlines a number of other statutory requirements that we're responsible for. If it wasn't for DSL accommodating the public review of other agencies, such as Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, our State Historic Preservation Office, DEQ water quality reviews, we'd have to go do those individually on our own. That's all accommodated in the removal fill permit process, and we find that to be a valuable service. Give you some examples of some of the service that we've experienced and we've valued in the recent past. DSL has been engaged in an effort to acquire the responsibility of administering Section 404 of the Clean Water Act. In that effort, they've kept us up to date and involved and engaged in the process. I've never felt I've been out of the loop. If I've missed a meeting or an opportunity to keep abreast of what that effort's about, I just contact someone at DSL and I'm up to speed and tracking it on behalf of our membership. They brought in representatives from the state of Michigan and the state of New Jersey, which are implementing an assumed Section 404 program from the Environmental Protection Agency. That's been a value to us to see how this program works in other states. I think they go above and beyond the effort of delivering a service to protect the wetlands and waterways of the state of Oregon. They've also been engaged in an effort to pursue a statewide programmatic general permit, referred to as an SBGP. This is a U.S. Army Corps of Engineers permit that is administered by a state agency such as DSL. In pursuing that permit, and they're almost close to getting it, if we had when we get an SBGP in the state of Oregon, it will basically eliminate the need to have to seek a permit from DSL and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which is what we have to do currently for some of our smaller projects. By consolidating that into a single permit, they're saving us a lot of money and a lot of headache, and we value that service. They provide us, they provided me with a great deal of assistance in providing information and guidance to our members on navigating the permitting process for bridge replacements and rehabilitation. As you know, some of our county road departments are replacing their bridges, and they have to comply with the law, and I've been, with the assistance of DSL, been able to keep our members abreast of what are the requirements, what do they need to know when seeking consultant services. Basically, in a nutshell, I feel that I can go to the DSL at any point in time with an issue, get it addressed, or at least have our concerns heard. Or if I have a question, I know that I get an immediate, very quick turnaround time on response to the questions that I pose. Thank you for your time.
Mr. Stonebrink.
Thank you, Chair Morgan, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Stonebrink, and I'm with the Oregon Cattlemen's Association. This may be one of those rare times when you see the Oregon cattlemen here to support more money for more people for government. But I am doing that today. I reference page 287.
I'm dreaming.
We've got a doctor in the room.
He may be in trouble, too. I'm not sure it was that lunch.
On your budget narrative, I will just keep speaking. I'll act like I do. The third bullet, when it talks about field operations, and then it says a natural resource specialist, too. What I'm talking about here is the position that deals with the permits that are issued to the cattlemen that graze livestock, or the livestock producers. They're not just all cattlemen, there are sheep producers as well. These permits have become under closer and closer scrutiny by certain groups that like to file lawsuits. And the ultimate would be, if the lawsuits are successful, is that our livestock producers would be out of business ultimately. And so these permits need more time to be done in a more thorough manner with more details, and to have monitoring that goes along with those grazing permits. And it is in that vein that I ask for your support for that position.
Questions or comments for either of these gentlemen? Representative Krieger.
We need that position funded. And earlier we talked about the wetland delineation. They're talking about increased fees, but you've been through that last time with fees. Within the Division of State Lands budget, is there any place particular that you think there are savings to be made?
Chair Morgan, Representative Krieger, I'm one of those guys that thinks in pretty simple terms, and this is not a surprise. I've stated this testimony before, in fact, before this committee last year. You know, we're talking about private property when we're talking about wetlands. That's private property. And there's two governments, that control and monitor and require permits, et cetera, on that same private land. Why do we have two governments doing that? Last time when I was here, I haven't done any research since then, but at the last session when I was here, I remember the figure well. It was $2.7 million in the red by the Department of State Lands to deal with the wetlands issue. That's common school money. And I said it then, I'll just say it again. If we could move faster if we didn't have two governments to deal with, and if the Department of State Lands didn't deal with wetlands on private property, you obviously could save $2.7 million or maybe more now. And I think someday this body has to take some real responsible steps in what you're dealing with when you deal with private property. That's restrictive, whether it's land use, whether it's wetlands or anything else, that curb the economy, cause an awful lot more cost to the landowner, and cost government. Thank you.
Well, that concludes the people that have been that have signed up to testify on House Bill 5045. So I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 5045. Members, on Monday we'll conclude the testimony for DLCD. On Tuesday and Wednesday we'll do DEQ. And on Thursday we'll begin the Department of Agriculture. And with that, the meeting, do you have anything more to add? The meeting is adjourned.